So you've lived and you've worked in Latin America for 32 years. So tell us about that and where you're living now. Just sort of give us a picture of
Sure.
who you are.
When I first went to Latin America, when I was in college, I was 20, went to Mexico for a Spanish course. And as soon, really, as I crossed that border and got on the train and began that journey to Mexico City, just felt that tug, felt that call to really be in Latin America. Really, what drew me even more deeply in after I'd been in Mexico, I went to Guatemala, to a small village of Chanmagua. This is 1977. Living in this village where weekly people were disappearing, people working with the farmers, the religious leaders, and in this context of this little village, we used to, for the mass, put the radio on the altar, and next door was the country of El Salvador, and the mass was given by Monsignor Romero, and so he was somebody who really, seeing him speak out in the face of what was happening in Latin America was a real call to me, and somehow called me to really be in Latin America, and one thing led to another, and now I've been there for 32 years. Ended up actually 25 of those in Venezuela, married a Venezuelan, and worked as a Merino lay missioner, worked doing community work in a barrio of Barquisimeto.
How do you see the coup against the Honduran president in that backdrop, that historical backdrop?
Well, the coup in Honduras very much has to do with the changes that I've seen and felt and lived that are coming about in Latin America. There have been so many changes. I would say in bold, sweeping terms, the 70s we lived through tremendous military repression, brutal times. The 80s and the 90s were another form of dictatorship and economic dictatorship, really, this whole neoliberal model privatized. And then in the past 10 years, I've kind of been in the heart of where in South America we see a whole new opening. I call it one big experiment, an experiment in new models different in each country, but new models saying that the past model didn't work. Let's try something new. Let's try something, a way in which citizens can really feel part of this country. And so we've seen this move towards constitutional assemblies, a move towards participative democracy. A move towards people really feeling included. We lived, so many years, people, the majority of the citizens in Latin America felt excluded. And so as these changes begin to go forward in a very positive way, I think they begin to inspire one another. We see very much a South-to-South moment now in Latin America. And so in Honduras, similar ideas were taking off. The social movements were gathering and talking about how to work towards creating a country that really worked for all of its citizens. And the other backdrop that's so important to understand in Central America, of course, is the tragedy of the years of the 70s, of the 80s, the legacy of so much bloodshed. Hundreds of thousands of people who lost their lives struggling to create a different society. And so today we have the same, if not worse, levels of poverty in Central America. And so the moment is saying, let's continue to look for deep change, but let's do it in a democratic way. Let's do it in a participative, in a different model. And so what we were seeing was the concept that of looking for an opening for holding a constitutional assembly. And of course, this is what led to eventually snowballed into the coup taking place because for of course, the wealthier business owners in Honduras, which are about 10 families, as well as for U.S. economic interests, these changes in Honduras were just too close to home.
Can you tell us a little bit more about those underlying conditions in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, both in Venezuela where you live and across Central America as far as poverty and the economic conditions?
Throughout, especially I would say the 70s in Latin America, was a time of tremendous repression against anything which was considered an expression of communism. Any effort to organize citizens to find ways to have a better life was interpreted as a push for communism. And so there was, in the name of putting out any fire, any tiny little spark that could lead to this, was justified atrocities, just really unnameable atrocities. And so we saw a time of so many military dictatorships, which were often helped to be set up by our country and certainly propped up and supported, a time in which the military had tremendous power, and the loss of just, again, hundreds of thousands of lives throughout the continent. And in most instances, those people precisely, the young, those who were idealists, who were looking for change, and so really a lost generation. This really moved, in many ways, seamlessly almost into from military dictatorships to economic dictatorships. Chile is a perfect example. You know, Pinochet opened the door for this whole, what we call in Latin America, the neoliberal model, the free market model. And the concept was privatize everything. You shrink government, privatize as much as you can, education, healthcare, services. And what this led to was really the lost decade, just a tremendous increase in poverty throughout Latin America, a decrease in every service, and a condition of what people began to refer themselves not only as poor, but excluded, really excluded entirely from society. So in this context, things began to shift. And I would say the shift really began where I live in Venezuela, and it's, I think, precisely because no one really paid attention to Venezuela. You know, Venezuela's, it's this country, it has oil, it didn't really have a military dictatorship. And so in the 80s, people are looking elsewhere at Central America or you know, the other things taking place in the rest of the world. And so with no one watching, Venezuela was really the first country to stand up to this neoliberal model. There was an incident which took place in February 1989, in which people spontaneously began to protest the rise in bus fares because the president was taking on all these measures which were imposed by the IMF, the World Bank, of course, as conditions of loans, and increased the price of public transportation. Well, people began to protest, and this led to enormous expressions of anger and outrage, and it spinned into looting, which led to putting the military in the streets, which had not really happened before in Venezuela. That led to 3,000 deaths. It's called the Caracazo. And that was really the beginning of an awakening in Venezuela that this model, we're not going to accept it, this neoliberal model. And that the outcome of that, of course, was the election of Chavez and his whole concept. He was really elected on the idea, let's take a new look at our country. Let's think, you know, what we know what we don't want, but what do we want? How would we shape a society that we want? And that just dramatically energized people, the concept of being invited, being called to look at what we do want. And so a constitutional assembly was convened over many months, in which people participated, consulted, offered ideas, and in about a 9-month process, it created this document, which is. Kind of almost the Bible of Venezuela. It's their constitution. It's a beautiful document, very inclusive and very very inspirational. And so this was the model for this Venezuelan experiment, which is now 10 years into the making. And it's basically working. We call it an experiment. There's some things that work, some things that don't. It's a proceso, as we say. And so this experiment began to, in very different ways, influence or inspire, I would say, inspire other countries to do the same. And so we've seen several other experiments, such as this taking place in Bolivia, a very, very amazing experiment, an indigenous leader elected, a constitutional process in Ecuador and in many other parts of South America. So now in Central America, in Honduras, really more than even in South America, the conditions of poverty just have only increased since the turbulent years of the 80s. Honduras is the third poorest country in the hemisphere. So this is a little bit of the backdrop, why there was a desire for change. Of course, in Central America, it's important to include the fact that Honduras was really used by the U.S. as its base to extinguish the flames all around in Central America. It became kind of what's referred to as the USS Honduras. It was their base. It was their ship of operations against the rest of Central America. And so it's a country in which the U.S. has felt like they have in the palm of their hands and are obviously very surprised at changes that have taken place there.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the U.S. military connection and presence in Honduras?
Mm-hmm. Yes, starting in the 80s, there was a tremendous increase, first of all, in military aid to Honduras. It jumped from about 4 million to 77 million in a space of a few years, if you can imagine. We began to not only send large numbers of troops to Honduras, but mostly to train Honduran troops and to train the Contras, of course, of Nicaragua, Honduras borders on El Salvador and on Nicaragua and on Guatemala. And in these years, there was tremendous turbulence, of course, and also some tremendous new exciting experiments taking place in these countries. And so Honduras was really used as a launching point to try again to put out these flames, the Contras then, of course, flying in and murdering so many in Nicaragua. Also, many people in Honduras fled into Honduras from these other countries, and the military sought them out, and they were disappeared. Not only Hondurans, but people from other countries. We currently still have access to a very important Air Force base. It's called Palmerola. We have over 500 soldiers stationed there, and so it still is a stronghold. Also, Honduras has sent very large amounts of troops to study at the School of the Americas. It's a small country, and yet they've trained about 5,000 troops from Honduras at the School of the Americas. And so another way also to keep that connection between the Honduran military and the military of the U.S.
If you could also help us see what connections are there between the personnel who've carried out attempted coups in Venezuela and the personnel involved in this more recent coup in Honduras. Mm-hmm. Are these, can you tell us more about who these people are?
Yeah, you know, they were kind of similar scenarios in some ways in Venezuela and in Honduras, especially those who actually orchestrated the coups. In Venezuela, the coup to remove President Chavez in April of 2002 was a combination of some members of the military and especially members of the business elite. A man named Carmona was swore himself in as president of Venezuela when the military removed President Chavez. The military who led this coup, two of them were graduates of the School of the Americas. And we see similar things taking place in Honduras. President Zelaya was also removed by the military physically, as was President Chavez. He was actually flown out of the country, flown into Costa Rica. And the two military officers who were in charge of his removal, the Army General Romeo Vasquez Velasquez and the Air Force General Luis Javier Prince Suazo were also graduates of the School of the Americas. Another graduate of the School of the Americas, the lawyer for the Army, later expressed to the Miami Herald, trying to justify this action, he said, you know, I know what we did perhaps was illegal, but we were trained that way at the School of the Americas, that, you know, to not have a leftist president. And so in this way, we justify what we did.
And when you're speaking about Carmona, so he was involved in Venezuela. Apparently, he set up something called the Arcadia Foundation that launched a campaign accusing Zelaya of corruption. So this gets us into talking about sort of pre-coup wranglings and rumblings and, you know, both who is Micheletti himself, what's his history, where does he come from? I don't think the media in the U.S. is sort of discussing that, as well as sort of these lead-up charges, creating a condition using the media in Honduras to accuse the Zelaya government of corruption, almost tit for tat. Every time he would do something like raise the minimum wage, there was an accusation of his deep corruption. Can you sketch that pre-coup conditions again with who the players are and what their interests are?
Well, you know, in Honduras, I think what's happened is it surprised everybody, even the Hondurans themselves. They elected as president, Zelaya, Manuel Zelaya, some 3.5-4 years ago, really, again, they had two parties, very traditional parties, who very much controlled the electoral situation. And so Zelaya was elected kind of as the safe candidate. As a matter of fact, he was the preferred candidate of the U.S. embassy. Was a rancher, was a wealthy man, wealthy businessman. And so he was seen to be safe to all the establishment of Honduras. And again, Honduras is a country in which about 10 families own about 90% of the businesses there. So he was among them. He perhaps wasn't in the 10 families, but certainly friends with them. So when things began to change, and it was slowly, really, it wasn't that Zelaya came in as somebody that the business community was concerned about. Quite the contrary. They were very thrilled with him. He at one point, when I spoke with him, he said, you know, I asked my fellow businessmen to help me. You know, we have a very poor country. Is there something, you know, in some way that you can contribute? And he said, basically, they turned me down. He said, and so I began to look to the people who had always been trying to improve our country. And so many of them were the leaders of the social movements. And began to sit down with them and listen to them. I witnessed this at a meeting that I went to with Zelaya, with about 25 leaders of the social movements. It was a six-hour meeting. It was a six-hour meeting in which they were discussing amazingly profound issues, whether to continue with CAFTA, whether to allow the U.S. to continue to use the Palmerola base, whether to send troops to the School of the Americas. And so he began to dialogue in a very open and honest and deep way, I think, with sectors of the society that no president of Honduras really ever had dialogued with. And so, you know, he admitted, he said that was a learning experience. And he began to perhaps see some things in a different way and take some different steps. And one of those that really began to send ripples to the business community was when the minimum wage was changed. Usually in Honduras, there's a dialogue to determine the minimum wage between the labor unions and the business leaders. And when it comes to an impasse, it comes to the president. And he said, you know, when it came to him, he asked his aide to find out what it costs for a family of four in Honduras just to eat. And he said, well, as a minimum, that has to be the minimum wage. And that actually turned out to be a 60% increase in minimum wage. And so you can imagine the effect on the business community of such a decision. And so he also began to look at things such as the tax code, the tax laws, and to realize there were some great things in the books that weren't translating into action, you know, for the business community. They were finding ways always to get out of paying the appropriate taxes. And so he began to impose new regulations that were, you know, making the business have to pay the taxes that were already in the books. And so these were sending ripples. Another major source of concern for the business community was the fact that rather than going deeper into the world of privatization that had been pushed upon Latin America for so many years, he was pushing back against that. And so the telecommunications company of Honduras, Ondutel, was nationalized, but there was pressure to privatize it. He was refusing to do that. He was propping up the national industry. This brought in the interest, of course, of many in Honduras and outside of Honduras. So this Arcadia Foundation, in which a brother of the Carmona, who overthrew the Venezuelan president, was involved, was interested in this issue. But their way of their tactic was to try to spread word that Zelaya was corrupt. That was their way of trying to give people incentive to not trust Zelaya. What they didn't realize was that people were coming more and more to trust him precisely because they felt like he was listening to them and making decisions that reflected their needs to become full citizens. And so there was a growing concern, again, in the business community that this man, Zelaya, was not that safe person they thought he would be, and the ground was shaking beneath them in Honduras. Perhaps the straw that broke the camel's back would be the fact that Zelaya joined an organization called ALBA. ALBA is the alternative to the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas. It's called the Bolivarian Alternative of the Americas. And it's a new model of relating between countries in the South. It's an organization in which Venezuela launched it, Venezuela, Cuba, now also Ecuador, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Granada belong to this organization. Uruguay and Paraguay have also asked to join. And Honduras joined ALBA recently. It's an organization of looking at trade in a very different way. It says rather than each one trying to outdo the other, it's how can we mutually benefit one another? What do we each have as a resource that we can, you know, share or trade with others and get the resources that we need? And so in that way, you see Cuba, who has doctors, you know, sending them to Venezuela. Venezuela has oil, or Bolivia has soy. Uruguay has cows and cheese, for example. So it's a very, it's an attempt to look at how can we mutually benefit one another. And it really reflects a new mindset in South America that we hear again and again. The phrase that's used is nuestro norte es el sur, means our north point, our compass point is now the south. It's now one another. And a big contributor to this south-to-south spirit is actually a media source. It's a TV station called Telesur, which was started in Venezuela and now has outlets. It's seen throughout Latin America. It's even can be seen here in the U.S., and it's very much the news from the South and to the South. And so people are becoming so much more aware of one another as neighbors, as brothers and sisters. And so this joining of ALBA by Celaya was one of the conditions, again, that began to rock the boat in Honduras and perhaps lead the steps up to what took place, the coup.
Well, you've really sketched out some of the economic advancements that he was part of, and some of the anti-privatization stances. I understand he also vetoed a ban on the morning after pill. And as much as I want to focus on the economic underpinnings of the coup, I wonder if there's some of that kind of social relations new thinking across both all of Latin America, South America, Central America, and then how much was that problematic, or is that just something I'm particularly concerned about?
No, I mean, I think that when Celaya allowed the morning after pill, it had been banned, allowed that to be sold in Honduras. This was another big thing that rocked the boat, that shook the waters in among the powerful in Central America, and among the powerful, of course, is the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church has had a stronghold, of course, on governments throughout Latin America, and again, these shifts have begun in South America. In Venezuela, one of the parts of the new constitution is a total freedom of religions. And prior to that, the Venezuela government paid the salaries of the bishops, built the bishops' conference, funded Catholic schools. And so this new constitution gives equal regard to Buddhism, to atheism, to native people's spiritualities and religions. And so of course, when the clergy, when the hierarchy speaks out against Chavez or about the changes there, they omit that part. You know, they criticize him in many ways, but it's that economic. The Catholic Church was propped up tremendously in an economic way from the government, and so there's been real opposition of the changes taking place in Venezuela and other places on the part of the Catholic hierarchy, not of the priests, the sisters working, especially among the poor. So similarly, in Honduras, when this ban against the morning after pill was lifted by Celaya, this, of course, angered the Catholic Church. And so once the coup took place, one of the first figures to step up to the plate and to support the coup, to speak out in favor of the coup, was the Cardinal of Honduras. And so again, just the waters were being shaken. But there was so many things that were being shifting in Honduras, and so different leaders were really gathering. It was something actually open gathering to ask what should we do about the situation with Celaya, and so meetings were taking place among some groups that were actually receiving funding from the United States through our funds for supposed democracy development. And so some of these groups were meeting and I imagine strategizing and pulling together the strategy, which took place on the morning of June 28th. You know, at heart of this is really not Celaya. It's the fact that Celaya began to connect to the social movements who were looking at how to bring about change in their country. And so he was really influenced by them. They were the ones who had this concept of holding a ballot, a fourth ballot, to be added to the presidential elections of November. Elections are scheduled on November 29th for the president, for members of Congress, for mayors and governors. And they had the idea of adding a fourth ballot, which would consult the population as to whether or not they would want to have a constitutional assembly. So in order to get that on the ballot in November, the idea came about of putting a referendum out, a non-binding poll, a non-binding referendum, which was scheduled for June 28th to consult the population. It was kind of a popularity poll. You know, do you think this issue should be placed on the ballot in November? And the ballot said very briefly, it said, are you in agreement that in the general elections of 2009, a fourth ballot be installed in which the people decide whether to convene a national constitutional assembly? So this was what was going to be voted on June 28th. And we had been to Honduras just a few weeks before this, and it was clear that there was tremendous energy around this issue. It was really seen as an opening, you know, a country which was suffering so deeply in poverty and kind of a no way out, and such a history of violence around them in preceding decades. And so the concept of peacefully, democratically holding an election, putting this on the ballot to get the election of a constitutional assembly on the ballot, was a way of redirecting this energy, which was saying something has to give, something has to change. You know, this poverty, this exclusion, it cannot continue. And so in some ways, you know, it should be seen positively, even obviously from the United States, because it's a directing energy in a nonviolent, participative, democratic way of looking for how to shape a society. But this ballot was slated for June 28th, and it was that morning at 5 a.m. in the morning in which President Zelaya was in his in bed in the presidential palace, and armed, masked members of the armed forces blasted their way into the presidential palace, overcame the presidential guard, came to where President Zelaya was sleeping, and threatened either to kill him or to take him out of the country in a plane. And so this, of course, was, again, the outcome of the fear, you know, of this ballot, because the truth of the matter is, this ballot was going to win. I mean, why bother to have a coup to remove a person if you felt like this was going to fall on its face? You know, and they're always saying it to the press that, oh, you know, he was so unpopular, this was going to lose. You know, well, why not then just allow it to lose and right, show that that it had no backing? But the truth of the matter, and it was very clear being there, that there was tremendous support and excitement around this issue.
Well, what you're saying is in direct contradiction to what we hear on Fox News and also CNN in the U.S., that Zelaya was trying to grab power. So because that's sort of the story here, can you talk a little bit more about this referendum for constitutional assembly? What really would a constitutional assembly mean as far as this participatory sort of moving towards experimenting, moving towards changing the grinding poverty? What would that really look like? What was so threatening about that formation? Not Zelaya, but what was threatening about this constitutional assembly for some folks there?
Right. The idea of having a constitutional assembly in Honduras really did not begin with President Zelaya. It began as a dialogue among the social movements in Honduras. Again, they were really coming together in quite an extraordinary way. Often groups have their different agendas, and it's kind of hard to come together. But for some reason in Honduras, there was a real dialogue between the different social movements, and they formed this popular bloc, they called it, and were beginning to meet and coming up with what was their agenda? What common themes did they see important to their country? And as they dialogued, they realized, you know, there need to be structural changes to allow for more participative democracy. Honduras is a country, again, with a handful of wealthy people. Those families are the ones who pretty much bankroll the members of Congress who are elected. In turn, the members of Congress are the ones who actually name the members of the Supreme Court. And so there was little opening, really, for participation on the part of citizens. So this concept was already taking off among the social movements, and a dialogue began between the president and these social movements. Again, once he became disillusioned with his own class of businessmen, he turned to them and began to dialogue. And out of this dialogue, he became convinced that this was indeed a way, a peaceful way of rechanneling energy and finding a way to build a different society that works for all Hondurans. And so they were looking at what steps to take in order to really consult the people whether they were in agreement with this. And so that was what was set for June 28th, was a consultative. It was, again, a non-binding, it was a poll to see what people thought of the idea, with the concept that if this does win big, if there's big support, then this likely can get on the ballot in November. And so this was the way in which things were moving. This was the reason to hold this ballot. And what has been interesting and very sad for me to see from here, from the U.S., is how inaccurately this vote was portrayed and how ready-made was the reasoning behind why Zelaya was removed almost immediately. It was almost as though a script were prepared that was handed to the press as soon as Zelaya was on the ground out of the country in Costa Rica. The reason was given, well, because he was pushing for re-election. And to find any justification for that, you know, they themselves, the opposition, the coup leaders would say, well, because, you know, if this Constitutional Assembly had been passed and if they had convened and if they decided then a president could be elected more than one term, then he might have run again and then he might have won. You know, all these maybes. So for all these maybes, he was militarily violently removed from office. And so it's really quite absurd, the reasoning. So again, not to say that who knows down the road, would that have happened? It certainly wasn't the main motivating factor for a constitutional assembly. I mean, the motivating factor is the lives of the Honduran people, the poor. It's you know what we ignore. It's not the main issue was not a power push of a president. It was a desire of a people to really have a country that is their country. Now Zelaya intersected with that, and how much of his changes are lasting, I can't guarantee. You know, I don't know. He went through apparently, you know, profound changes, his opinions from the past to the present. How much of those are lasting? How much he will continue to listen to those, to the poor, to the social movements? Or how much of it is something which served his own interests? I can't speak to that. But it was a quite historical coming together of someone who was elected in office and a movement representing really the people at the base coming together in a way that looked like it was going to open a whole new space for the country.
Let's talk some more about the social movements, mm-hmm. the different constituencies within it. I know there's a lot of exciting leadership from women. Mm-hmm. A lot of the indigenous women are really taking this moment to lead. And that perhaps is more of an ongoing, longer-lasting thing than any one evolving, transforming or not politicians.
Exactly.
So, you know, who are they? What are they really coming together to, as you said, it was a process.
Right.
What's this experiment and this process on the social movement level?
Yeah, the social movements in Honduras are it's a fascinating group. It's a fascinating movement that has deepened, obviously, profoundly with the removal of Zelaya. It was again a coming together of different people in society who really representing those who were disenfranchised, the indigenous groups, environmental groups, and many of the environmental groups were linked to the indigenous movement, human rights organizations that had been for years, you know, looking at the issue that disappeared in Honduras and the continued repression of the military. Farmers who had no access to land, looking at ways to get access to land and to cooperatives for Hondurans, and so these these different groups, each with their perhaps set of interests, were beginning to dialogue. And that's where the energy came, you know, when they came together and began to communicate with one another. Now, once the coup took place, this was, of course, something that no one expected. And so immediately, what was fascinating, because I was there just days after the coup, was to see this resistance movement. And I sat in on a meeting of theirs days after the coup, and to see the amazing organization that they had and connection and really kind of surprising lack of friction. And I think because precisely they had been coming together in weeks and months prior to this, it already shaped kind of gave a shape to this resistance movement. And so it was something which allowed for the average Honduran who was outraged at this coup, at their democratically elected president being removed, to connect to this resistance movement. It really gave it shape in a very quick way. It's now been, you know, many days since the coup took place, and so in those weeks and months following the coup, the people have remained in the streets. You know, at one point I called friends in Honduras to say, how are you doing? I called a human rights leader, Berta Oliva, and she said, Lisa, we're all probably 10 pounds lighter. You know, we've been in the streets day after day, week after week. She said, but to tell you the truth, we're surprised at ourselves. You know, we've come out, we've come forward, we're resisting. We're in a very brave and very daring and very bold way. And again, sectors of society that previously weren't the leaders, for example, the taxi drivers, you know, all going on strike and the impact that had. Women, the resistance women, feminists in resistencia, they call them, have been tremendous leaders in this movement and just very bold in standing right up the front line against the military. So it's been a surprise, I think, to them. You know, no one, again, anticipated this, but precisely because there was this organization, this coming together prior to the coup, it was able to continue and to strengthen. And so it's been amazing to see the numbers of Hondurans. You know, when I tried to get back to Honduras after the coup, it was the same day that President Zelaya was trying to return in July, July 5th, trying to land. That day, 100,000 Hondurans came to the airport. But the same day, what happened was President Zelaya's plane tried to land, but the military put tanks on the runway. So he was unable to land and changed his route to El Salvador. I happened to arrive in El Salvador precisely because they'd closed the airports in Tegucigalpa. And so I arrived that day in El Salvador, and as I exited the airport, went out the doors of the airport to see a sea of Salvadorans outside the door. And many of them had T-shirts of Romero and FMLN shirts. And I thought maybe there was some conference, major conference going on. And, you know, I came to the crowds and said, you know, what's going on? And they said, well, President Zelaya was trying to return to Honduras and the runway was blocked. He couldn't make it. And so his plane is coming to El Salvador and we're coming to greet him. And so it was so moving to see, to be part of this crowd. And they also said, you know, there are four presidents coming to accompany him. And as I joined the crowds, and as we waited, four planes landed, one carrying the president of Ecuador, Rafael Correa, one carrying the president of Argentina, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, one with the president of Paraguay, Fernando Lugo, the head of the OAS, the president of El Salvador was coming to the airport. And so it was an amazing moment, which to me was almost a physical expression of what I've been living. And I've found it hard to explain to people in the United States what I've been living in these years in Latin America. It's a moment of coming together, of really looking south to south, of, again, that concept, nuestro norte es el sur, our compass point is now the south. And it's a very powerful, empowering feeling. You know, for so many decades, it's a look to the north, you know, go to the north or try to get there and, you know, get a job there or get funds or get loans or whatever from the U.S. But this awakening, really, a lot of this was the dream of Simón Bolívar. Let's look to one another. I mean, we're we're huge. You know, it's a huge continent, and basically we share one language. You can even understand Portuguese and Spanish one another, and very similar culture and traditions and history, and so, and the amount of natural resources, you know, in Latin America. And so this new concept of let's look to one another. And so in this crowd, one of the signs that they were carrying was a sign, many people were carrying a sign that said, todos somos Honduras, we are all Honduras. And I think that is what's so important to understand, is that what is taking place in Honduras, the coup that took place there, there's a feeling in Latin America it took place against all of us. And so it's also extraordinary in which you see that expressed not only by the people, but by many of their governments. And so a rejection of the coup on the part of every single Latin American government, every single one. And in among the people, you know, as I was heading, this was maybe a week and a half after the coup, I was heading to the airport in Venezuela to take a plane, and I got in a taxi, you know, and I began to talk to the taxi driver and ask how it was going. And he said, I'm so worried. And I said, you know, I thought maybe it was something happened to his family or his job or whatever. And I said, oh, really? He said, yeah, I'm so worried about what's happening in Honduras. You know, and this is a Venezuelan taxi driver. And, you know, he went on to talk for a half hour about the situation there. It felt like it was happening to him. You know, Honduras isn't even next door to Venezuela, but that was the sense, and that continues to be the sense, the outcome, you know, of what happened in Honduras, what happens in Honduras. There's a feeling that this is all of us.
How do you, as a longtime activist, make the connection then between the taxi driver in Venezuela who feels like it's directly affecting him? What do you say to people in the U.S. so that people in the U.S. have that same sense of we are all Honduras?
Well, you know, there's a sense, too, of we are Las Americas, you know, America. And in being in Venezuela in these past years, so many organizations, groups have come down to take a look. You know, it's something different. And inevitably, people come back animated. They come back energized. I would say not so much to come, well, let's do Latin American solidarity, but energized for what they can do in their own community. There's this sense of empowerment, a sense of being full citizens, a sense of this participative democracy makes you feel like there really is something you can do to transform your community, your society. And that's very energizing. And so I think what is happening in Latin America is something which is fabulous for all of us. I mean, even on some concrete terms, you know, for example, in Venezuela, there are now, there's very low unemployment, 7% unemployment. People have access to education, to healthcare, everyone's studying. And so your average Venezuelan isn't going to consider leaving and trying to get through the border and come, you know, find a job on the street corner here in the U.S. They're going to stay in their country. You know, people want to be where their families are, where their traditions, where their culture. And so as these experiments actually work, as they, and a big part of the experiment is taking their natural resources and saying, these resources are for the benefit of our people. These resources that ended up in the pockets of multinationals and wealthy people within these countries, for example, oil in Venezuela, how do we redirect that to services for ourselves? And so it's only a win-win situation. Again, when these countries, the economic situation is improved, when there is access to all people for education, healthcare, et cetera, then it's only going to benefit us as well. And I also think, you know, my daughter grew up, my three kids grew up in Venezuela. Their father's Venezuelan. And when she came here to go to school, and people would often say to her, you know, oh, we're American and you're Venezuelan. And she's like, she always corrects them. She says, no, she says, I'm American too. You know, you're North American, I'm South American, but we're all American. So I think that's something that is part of this concept of the Americas.
What do you say to people that have a hard time embracing your vision of setting the compass to the South?
Mm-hmm. I don't really know if I would say in the U.S. the need is to set the compass to the South, but I do think the sense of setting the compass to one another, you know, in Latin America, this is the South in the sense of to one another as nations. And I'm also not overly idealistic. You know, the changes that we've attempted in Latin America we've had to face down guns and bloodshed. You know, it's not been a merry journey, and it continues. I mean, there's tremendous threats, and for example, the recent decision of the United States to use 7 military bases in Colombia. You know, in Venezuela, we're right next door. And, you know, saying, wait a minute, you know, here we're moving forward with this experiment, which is working for us, for the people of Venezuela. It constantly is criticized and by the U.S. And now you're stationing troops in 7 7 military bases right next door. So I don't mean to be idealistic at all in the sense that there's a lot of potential danger around the corner. But the changes that are taking place are a threat to economic interests of obviously to big business. But I think what I'm saying is that we found in Latin America that ways that seem small of participating as citizens that really lead to big things. And so I think that's where the inspiration is. It's again, I think we'll be defeated if we just, you know, and perhaps is that moment here in the U.S. You know, we elected a very different person. And so where's that magical moment? It hasn't either been magical in Venezuela or Latin America either. It's been a poco a poco, you know, it's a little by little. But we do have to take that first step of kind of believing in ourselves and those small things that can be done, but also fully aware, alert to the changes that we are trying to bring about are a threat to certain interests. And so I don't know if a year from now in Venezuela we'll still have, you know, this process unfolding. I don't know, given those military bases, given what's happening in Honduras, that situation, the fact that this coup government was allowed to be in power for so long, that's really emboldening really the opposition groups in Venezuela, in Nicaragua, in El Salvador, et cetera, et cetera. And so, again, I don't mean to be idealistic. I think there's real concerns and threats to these changes that are being attempted.
Could you focus in on some of the corporations, though? Because you say business interests, but when I think about Honduras or Colombia and Peru, and what fields and what specific corporate interests are there? Because in some ways, they almost supersede or somehow precede governmental actions, it seems. Mm-hmm. There's some relationship there that I wonder if you could tease that out more, mm-hmm, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, some of the business interests that are being threatened, as I mentioned earlier, are the actual services in a country. And so in Venezuela, for example, there had been a move towards privatizing the oil company, a move towards privatizing electricity, water, et cetera. Imagine the amount of interest in a company taking over the electricity of all of Venezuela, or, you know, et cetera. So this is, again, similar in Honduras, a push to privatize. And so the telecommunications company is a good example of this because, again, there was strong pressure towards privatizing Ondutel, pressure being put upon President Zelaya. And meanwhile, there was a lot of interest in others in that privatizing that industry. For example, John McCain, much of his backing is from telecommunications companies. And John McCain was the one who hosted those representing the coup government when they came to Washington. And so in terms of industries, the banana companies, Chiquita, Dole, felt tremendously the effects of, for example, the increase in wages. Again, the interests of these big businesses and corporations both trying to privatize industries, privatize services in Central America, or hold on to the privatization of the services they'd already privatized, is enormous, really.
Could you talk a little bit more? Way back this past summer during the coup, what was some of the U.S. response and what role did they play in the different negotiations?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the immediate response of President Obama was very surprising and pleased the people of Latin America. He said, there's been a coup. We may not agree with everything that President Zelaya says, but we honor the right of the Hondurans to elect a president, and we support the return of President Zelaya. So this surprised in a very positive way the people of Latin America. It was a very different response than perhaps would have come from the previous administration. However, following statements mostly came from the State Department in the following months, and the tone was very different. The word coup was no longer used for quite a bit. It was referred to as the troubles or the difficulties or the problems, and there was no clear call for the return of Zelaya. There was a call for the actors to come together to mediate dialogue. And Hillary Clinton decided it was upon her to self-appoint who would negotiate that. And she hand-appointed President of Costa Rica, Oscar Arias, to lead a mediation effort between the coup government and between Zelaya and his government. So many in Latin America were surprised by this. I heard a friend share from Costa Rica herself. She just came from Costa Rica, saying the Costa Ricans said, "Well, why? Who is, you know, Arias, or why decide handpick him, and why the U.S. handpick him? You know, this isn't the way things go." So indeed, that really led to a dead end. There really wasn't deep backing of Latin America behind that process, and it led to a dead end. In more recently, as time went on. And the pressure was put upon the Obama administration to respond differently. Secretary of State Clinton met again with Zelaya, and this time agreed to call it a coup, but she left out the term, calling it a military coup. And this word is not just a small adjective; it's an adjective that implies. Legally having to withdraw all aid from a country if it is determined that it is a military coup. So the U.S. had only withdrawn about 30 million of aid. Much, much more aid was still left in place. And so this determination of it being a military coup is something that was really important. Again, it's kind of been a dance. I think in some ways it's the Obama administration trying to figure out how do they relate to Latin America. And I think they've gone back and forth and all around. But in general, I would say their response has been kind of disappointing to Latin Americans who had put really high hopes on Obama. There was a sense that change was coming to the U.S. in U.S. relations to Latin America with his elections. And so this is really a trial by fire. And so at least in the initial months, the very weak, the response that was really kind of almost a wink and a nod to the coup government saying, oh, we'll pull out a little bit of aid and, you know, we'll try to get this thing negotiated, but not really doing enough on our part. Again, it's not up to the U.S. It's not our responsibility to fix this. It's a Honduran situation. It's a Latin American situation. All we can fix is our own relationship and make that an appropriate response. We left our ambassador there. Everybody else pulled their ambassador out. The ambassador is somebody who was a Bush appointee who had been meeting with Micheletti and other people prior to the coup. And so he remains there. Tremendous millions of dollars remain in aid, not just humanitarian aid, but aid to democracy development, which ends up in hands of again, those who had helped to organize the coup. And so there needed to be a stronger response, just as who we are as a nation responding to another nation. And had that been more in consistent with what President Obama said initially, I think that the coup would have been short-lived.
I wonder if you have some final thoughts about response of just people listening to this program.
I think it's important that we take a look at what's happening in Honduras. I think it's important that we also are concerned that so little is said about something so outrageous taking place very near our borders. I find that people are telling me again and again, we can't even find information about Honduras. And so I find that outrageous. You know, it's a country that is so near. We as a nation have so many people who come from Latin America. It's a flow. We are the Americas. We are constantly interchanging, be it economically, be it with people. that border is being, you know, erased in the sense of a flow between continents. And so it's imperative to us to really know what happens, especially with something so major as an overthrow of a government. And so I do feel a lot of outrage in terms of the limited attention given by the press and by the tremendous inaccuracies. Almost always it's about a one sentence or two sentences or one paragraph. And the reason for the coup is almost always stated as being that President Zelaya was seeking re-election. And this is just false information. And so I think we need to see in the situation of Honduras not only concerns for how our country is responding there, but also concerns that we really have very little access to understanding what's going on in the rest of the world. And this is dangerous, you know, because I think a lot of the hot spots where we are and have gotten involved in is precisely because we don't really understand the thinking, the thoughts, the lives of other countries. And, you know, I live in a city of Barquisimeto, and my local paper carries far more international news than the New York Times. You know, so we as Venezuelans, as in the small towns, really know more of what's happening in the world than we do in this country. And so I think that's again, one of the learning points of the situation of Honduras. We really need to demand more real information of what's happening beyond our borders.